This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today we're talking about President Joe Biden's first 100 days, as well as his recent address to Congress. If you have any questions or comments for the show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. With us now are two guests, Ray Haberski, Professor of History and Director of American Studies at IUPUI, and Elizabeth Bennion, Professor of Political Science at IU South Bend. Welcome to both of you.
Hello.
Good to be here.
I'll start with you, Ray. Before we go into the details of President Biden's first 100 days, why is this a measurement that's used for presidential performance? Where did it come from?
It comes from FDR. And it's never really been used as a great metric ever since. So FDR's first 100 days, of course, came in the wake of the most serious economic depression in American history. FDR was elected with large majorities in both houses. And he set the tone, you know, very early on in his inaugural address and very much in the kind of policies he thought he would support. But for the most part, you know, FDR was a leader. A lot of the legislation came out of Congress. It wasn't just out of the White House. But what he did was he helped to stabilize the American economy, and he began providing direct assistance to Americans who had lost their jobs. You know, the unemployment rate in, when he took office, you know, hovered around one-third in some places in the United States. And FDR simply provided a way for people to imagine a better future by creating a sort of a flurry, signing a flurry of pieces of legislation. And from that point forward, in his first 100 days, you know, a lot of this happened, presidents have been measured by the sort of artificial metric about how much they get done in the first 100 days. Harry Truman, his successor, did actually get quite a bit done in his first 100 days. But ever since then, it has been mixed at best.
Well, you're saying this is an artificial metric. Is it reasonable to keep this review? Is it just now part of our culture?
It's part of our culture. I mean, there really isn't any other reason to have it, to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's a convenient metric. To tell you the truth, one of the best ways to measure political success of a president is to look at the midterm elections after they got elected and to see what their party does in the midterm elections and how much they got done from basically the day that they took office to the midterm results.
Right. And Elizabeth, I noticed you're smiling there a little bit. What are your thoughts on this 100-day measurement?
Well, I think the same thing that Ray has already said. It's an artificial construct, but it does give a benchmark that presidents now shoot for to see how much they can accomplish in that first 100 days.
Mm-hmm. I think since it's become such a part of the culture, even I'm like, OK, the 100 days are here. You know, what's the big news? Yeah. And sometimes it's not that much.
And you can see that Biden was using it as a talking point, too. You know, I mean, he was right to do it, especially with the vaccine rollout. I thought that was a really good way for him to tell Americans how much they can measure his success. And you know, he exceeded the expectations that he had set for his administration. So that looks great.
Mm-hmm. And Elizabeth, what are your thoughts on how Biden did so far?
Well, economically, of course. Of course, the things are looking good for the president. More than 1.3 million jobs added in those first 100 days. He and Nancy Pelosi both like to point out that's more than the first 100 days of any other president. And also the IMF predicts a 6% growth this year. So that all looks good for a president that gets judged mostly on foreign policy, in this case, the pandemic, and also on the economy. The economy is growing at the fastest pace that we've seen in 40 years. Now, we know this isn't all things that Joe Biden has done. The economy always has a lag in terms of performance versus what policies take place. But this always helps a president in terms of approval ratings. It also doesn't hurt that he set that very specific goal regarding the vaccines of 100 million shots and then was able to more than double his success rate with more than 235 million shots in arms during those first 100 days. So by setting specific goals and being able to meet those, that gives him a lot of goodwill, especially among those who voted for him.
Is there a way to measure his success these first 100 days compared to former President Trump's first 100 days on the job?
Well, one of the things we know is that he is more popular than President Trump was at this particular juncture. We also, again, see that rapid economic recovery. So those are certainly things that the Biden administration will point to. Now, what we don't see is what he called for in his inaugural address, which is this promise to unify Americans. We see that there's still vaccine hesitancy among Republicans. We see that no Republicans are going along with many of these big, bold plans to reshape the economy. And we see that the chances of Joe Biden moving forward with the rest of his agenda may be slim, given that you have members of his own party who he desperately needs to help him get rid of the filibuster or agree to pass future legislation based on budget reconciliation, who are not on board. People like Senator Joe Manchin of Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, who say they aren't really interested in reforming the filibuster or certainly getting rid of it, and aren't sure that budget reconciliation is the way to go. Without that, it's difficult for Biden to continue this pace that he's set and these expectations that he's put out there for what he'll be able to deliver as we move past those first 100 days.
Mm-hmm. And so it seems that there's a need for a lot of bipartisanship. And if that still is kind of, there's not a lot of unity on a lot of fronts, that's going to be very difficult for the next 4 years.
It will be a big challenge to the Biden administration moving forward.
And Ray, I would say the bipartisanship goes beyond Congress as well, though. I think Biden mm-hmm. has been attempting to address a different kind of bipartisanship that exists inside the American electorate or the American public. And you can see that he keeps sort of focusing on that idea rather than what's going on in Congress, because Congress it's a hornet's nest in many ways.
Mm-hmm. And Ray, like when we look back at, I guess, historical situations, mm-hmm. is there anything that compares to the time that we're living right now where there is this distrust and this disunity?
Yeah, I mean, you could see something similar to this after Nixon resigned, and Ford becomes president. And there was this deep suspicion of government that had been brewing since the mid-1960s, the series of catastrophes in the 1960s, from the assassinations to the Vietnam War to the Pentagon Papers. And Ford actually had a great deal of goodwill, actually popular goodwill among the American press and the American electorate. And it sort of dissipated after he pardoned Nixon, but it was certainly crushed by the economy. So I think this is where, if Joe Biden, if the economy is favorable to him over the next 2 years, that his narrative will make more sense to people. But if it begins to falter or people see that the vaccine rollout is not going as smoothly as we all wish, or that places around the country are not opening up in a way that sort of improves their lives, and then people will yet again be questioning what's going on with the federal government, and Biden will be sort of the focus of that, potentially that focus of the animosity.
Mm-hmm. And Elizabeth, do you think if this vaccine distribution increases and the pandemic gets under control, would that have a positive impact for uniting the parties, or does that not matter at this point?
Well, it's very difficult to say. I think it would have a positive impact on the president's approval ratings initially, but then it also blunts the appetite for these big, bold restructuring plans. So a lot of the plans that the Biden administration has laid out are long-term Democratic goals, funding pre-K, funding higher education, moving up in terms of those corporate taxes, capital gain taxes, to do more for working Americans, for middle-class Americans, and really expanding a lot of services to people. And as people feel like their life is back to normal, and maybe there's not as they don't feel that need for government intervention, that could actually get in the way of some of these bold restructuring plans.
Mm-hmm. And Ray, I see you nodding in agreement.
Yeah, I think a lot of the perception of Biden and government in general is going to rest on how quickly people feel like they have confidence in their own future I mean, Biden has laid out a plan for what is coming anyway, right? I mean, we're going to be restructuring the economy one way or another. It really is going to depend a lot on who is going to take the lead in that. Is it going to be the private sector, which is basically what we've seen over the last, 30 years, or is government going to help the economy expand in places that it hasn't expanded in those 30 years? And that is a longer term sort of project. And it's not something that necessarily will be clear to voters at the midterm election time, which, again, is it's going to be a very delicate balance for the Democrats if they're going to try to build on whatever success they have over the next year and a half or so to leverage that in the fall elections.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you were to give Biden a grade, a letter grade for his actions so far, what would you score him?
Well, you know that it is the end of the term for both Elizabeth and I, so we're probably grading an awful lot right now. No, I think, I thought his speech was, like A-minus material, and mm-hmm. I think for the most part, what he's been laying out as a vision is in that, solid sort of B-plus shows a lot of promise range.
So that's what those stand for. Okay. Elizabeth, how about you?
I would agree. I think he's tried to meet the mood of the nation. He's shown a lot of initiative. He's taken an opportunity to try to capture a particular historical moment to lay out a bold, ambitious plan of programs that he'd like to see move forward. But we cannot give it a straight A because he hasn't been able to get people on board. Now, that may have been an impossible task from the beginning, but it still remains to be seen how, if this plan can actually be carried out.
Right. And so he'll have to get some extra credit in there somehow.
Right. Well, it's another term, it's another term.
Right. Well, we'll be back after a quick break and discuss more about Biden and some of his plans. Also touch upon the vice president and how she's been doing. We'll be back with our guests after a quick break. We're talking about President Biden's first 100 days and the next 100 and what they might have in store for our nation. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soeb. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. We're talking today about Biden's first 100 days in office, as well as the aftermath of the president's historic address to Congress. We love your questions and comments on the topic. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. And you can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. With us are two guests, Ray Habersky, professor of history and director of American studies at IUPUI, and Elizabeth Binion, professor of political science at IU South Bend. Elizabeth, let's talk about Vice President Kamala Harris, because I think Biden is getting a lot of the press here. What's her role been so far, and how has she been doing?
Well, I think that the vice president is still trying to define her role as the first Black, Asian, and female vice president, as well as her role as a leader in the Democratic Party. The reality is the vice president has no constitutional power except breaking tie votes in the Senate and, of course, assuming the presidency in the event that the president is incapacitated or killed. So her power really depends on how much Biden trusts her. And I think on that score, advisors say that the president frequently turns to her for advice. There were some who feared that she might outshine the president, that she might pursue her own priorities. I think she's taken this first 100 days to show herself to be a team player, to be a key part of the team, to be integral in formulating those ideas and communicating them to the public, but also in supporting the president and his agenda. And she's done very well in that. And I think that will mean that she'll have more power and more visibility moving forward.
And Ray, do you think that Vice President Kamala Harris has more of a high profile position than Vice President Mike Pence? Is she doing more than he did?
She's doing more. In some ways, she's not doing more because Mike Pence had an almost impossible task to manage so much of how the federal government operates sort of by perception and by relationships, because Donald Trump had very little interest in either. But I don't think former President Trump gave Mike Pence all that much officially to do. And that's that's another important thing to look at. While Vice President Harris will have official tasks and projects, and I think, as Elizabeth said, it is important to acknowledge that she is a woman who has achieved more power in, you know, the federal government than any other woman before. And she is a confidant of the president of the United States. She is, but she's also been given some space and some time to shape what that means and to craft an identity for women in the highest office of the United States. And that was something that, let's be frank, that Barack Obama really didn't have much time to do in a certain sense. He was constantly playing off extremes within within the country that he inherited. And I think Harris is so well suited for the job that she has. A lot of people have said that she has been training for this type of thing for her entire life, and I completely agree. But I think her role is only going to grow with time. But it's going to grow in a way that I think is manageable and probably quite effective.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do want to move on and talk a little bit about the presidential address to Congress that was said to be historic and full of bold plans. What was your thoughts on this speech?
I thought it was something that, in fact, set the tone in the wake of an insurrection the way that I would hope. Right. I mean, He Biden almost immediately emphasized two big things: that there were two women behind him holding very high offices in the government, and that he was here to declare that the United States and its democracy are still intact. That's big stuff. So you can't get much more profound than that.
And Elizabeth, what about you? What were your thoughts?
Yes, absolutely. I think he was trying to gain the confidence of the nation and to assure the people that he is ready to move forward with plans that will make their lives better. If we think about the content of the policies he's outlined, it really is about restructuring and reshaping the economy to work better for the U.S. people, or at least that's how Joe Biden sees it and how he hopes that people across the nation will see it.
Well, Elizabeth, do you think that some of the things that he proposed or brought up in his speech were too ambitious, such as the rescue plan?
Well, you know, of course, he's trying to do a lot, right? Lift the economy out of the COVID-19 recession, help us to get through the pandemic, restore blue-collar jobs, beef up U.S. infrastructure, which is badly in need of updating, secure education and childcare for American families, right? This is a huge plan to reshape the economy. And it is very bold. His American Rescue Plan, American Jobs Plan, American Families Plan has a lot of meat there, right? There are a lot of major policy proposals that would be new for the United States and moving it in a more progressive direction. Now, whether or not that can happen when you have a 50-50 split in Congress, when you have a very polarized electorate, and when you have so much disagreement in the nation about what the role of government should be, that's a bigger question. And that's why I think that it will be very challenging for the president to get these packages that he proposed passed in the exact format that he has proposed them.
Mm-hmm. And Ray, are there any things that were proposed during his speech that you think will have a positive impact and be able to move forward?
Yeah, I guess I would say this, that he had to set out what sounds like a bold vision. But when he's talking about, you know, how to pay for government supporting things that the country just simply desperately needs, that would put us on par with other developed countries around the world with, you know, healthcare or childcare, what kind of minimum wage people need, you know, to work in a job and not be able to support a family is crazy to most other developed countries in the world. He's simply asking to, like, repeal small tax large tax cuts back to, like, the pre-Trump era, or the marginal tax rate back to the era of George W. Bush, or the corporate tax rate back to what it was, you know, around Reagan. These are not, like, radical ideas. You know, he's not asking for people to be paying 60% rate in their income tax or something like that. So I think it is Biden is trying to play two sides here. He's trying to say that it's obviously time, because we're in the middle of a crisis, for bold thinking. But he's not saying that he is going to introduce something that's going to remake what our economy is based on. It is still a market-based economy. It is still an economy where people will become fabulously wealthy if they want to. He's really, as he said, he's trying to grow the economy from the middle out and provide people an opportunity to do what other people around the world simply expect when they wake up in the morning, you know, that they have decent transportation options, that their children have good, decent enough schools or good schools to go to, that women can work without feeling like they're either giving up their children or giving up a paycheck.
And Elizabeth, what are your thoughts on that?
I think that's right. And I think for members of the European Union listening to the speech, they would say, well, why wouldn't a country already have these things?
Right.
For U.S. conservatives listening to the speech, they are not used to paid family leave. They're not used to paid covered preschool. They're not used to funding 2 years of higher education. They're not used to $15 minimum wage. So they're hearing a very different narrative. And there has always been more of an emphasis on rights and less on responsibilities. We pay more in taxes, but get less for our taxes than some nations, right? And certainly than most European nations. And so there is just this rugged individualism within U.S. culture that certainly will be part of the Republican pushback to suggest that these ideas are radical, or that the way proposed to pay for them is radical and unwarranted, even if what we're really doing, as Ray mentioned, is rolling back to not too long ago in U.S. history. Right? The comparison instead will be to socialism and to the idea of attacking capitalism itself, even if President Biden is showing how he will pay for it. And of course, he has been specific with his explanations of how he would pay for this, which is raising the corporate tax rate from 21% to 28% to pay for his infrastructure package, and raising the top individual tax rate from 37% to 39.6% for his family plan, and capital gains tax from 20% to 39.6% for people making over $1 million. So these tax hikes wouldn't affect most Americans. A majority of Americans would support them, but that majority is mostly Democrats. And that's why this will be very controversial in the United States.
And speaking of the controversy surrounding some of these plans, how hard is it for the Biden administration to affect change on places like Indiana, where the majority in the state house is Republican?
Yeah, we take a look at the money that the state actually got, though, from the federal government recently. And we've been talking about this. I think you talked about it on the show, how flush the state is, relatively mm-hmm. speaking, and that it's able to give teachers a raise for the first time in years. That is in part because the federal government has assisted states and local governments.
Right, right. Would this create more unity, though, to see that a Democratic president and his administration is helping out a majority Republican state government?
Yeah. What do you think, Elizabeth? Politics about unity?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is the interesting part, right? The state house was able to pass that $37.4 billion two-year budget, including the $1.9 billion through K-12, because they ended up with that $2 billion extra to spend with that rosy April forecast, and because of the $3 billion from the National Recovery Act by the federal government. And so there's no doubt that that federal money helped to offset the cost that the states would have had to incur to help individuals, to help businesses, to help schools, to help universities, right? Everybody in the state has benefited from those funds. But if you talk to state house Republicans, they'll say, well, you know, we can debate whether or not what role the federal government played. It was really mostly state good management, you know, and so there's still a reluctance to suggest that the federal government really played a role in it and give too much credit there. And so I think certainly the state has benefited. We also see that the president outlined a number of issues, including police reform, and the state house created its own bipartisan police reform bill. So we've seen the state move forward on certain plans and proposals pushed by Joe Biden. We've seen the state benefit economically, and there's some acknowledgement of that, but it doesn't mean that they're all of a sudden ready to compromise across the board or get on board with the Biden administration's plans.
Mm-hmm. Ray, what would it take to kind of bridge this gap between the two parties?
Well, I think if I could answer it, there's an irony to this. Like I think that Republican districts are going to benefit from whatever Biden does if the economy improves. I mean, they can simply claim that, you know, they were part of the recovery too, without having to find a way to bridge the divide between the Democrats and the Republicans. I mean, it's really not to their political interest to do much of that right now. I think, you know, you've talked before on the show about gerrymandering and about how districts are drawn. And for the most part, they're drawn so that people can be rather comfortable with the choices that they've made in the past for their political parties. There really isn't much incentive at this point to build those bridges or to do something about the divide. But I think this is where Biden has learned something from his experience with the Obama administration, and that is to reach out to the American public and not worry too much about the Republican opposition, which is going to be there, and to see what he can do with the American public as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the American public. Elizabeth, we've talked a little bit about Biden's accomplishments and things, but what has the response been from the public? Are there any polls out or any information that would give us an idea?
Well, you know, response, the public is divided overall. The president does have a positive approval rating. The majority of people approve of the job that he's doing in office. But of course, there are partisan dimensions to this, with Democrats being much more favorable than Republicans, as we might expect. And so, you know, the decision is mixed. I also think that for a lot of people, the jury is out, right, as we move mm-hmm. toward midterm elections. And as the president tries to get through additional parts of his plans that he's announced, we may see some shifts. And part of that will depend also on what happens in reality. One of the things that we look at as political scientists is the way that reality affects campaigns. So what is happening with foreign policy, what is happening with the economy at the time an election takes place will really affect those midterm results. And so what will matter most the Biden administration and its future ability to get things done will be what happens in 2 years, almost 2 years now, with the midterm elections and what the public thinks then.
Right. So I guess it's all dependent upon these midterm elections. There could be some surprise upsets, I'm guessing. Ray, what are you thinking?
Historically, we'd expect him to lose his party, to lose seats in Congress. Mm.
So there's generally a pattern then.
Yes, that's right.
What about like with the next 100 days or the future for Biden? What do you see?
Yeah, I was just thinking that if you look back at other presidencies that were successful, typically there was either a sort of an extraordinary moment that brought the country together. I mean, you know, George W. Bush with 9/11 or Ronald Reagan with the attempted assassination. Or you begin to see how presidents begin to play sort of a ground game. So they create, rather than the focus all on them, they create other places or other ways to distribute their power or their prominence in other parts of the country and begin to generate a sort of a more of a grassroots popularity for the things that they want to accomplish. So I think that's one thing we could look out for over the next, let's say, you know, 3 to 6 months. Is especially this infrastructure plan, how that is rolled out, where it is rolled out, who takes leadership over it in certain sectors of the economy and certain regions of the country.
Mm-hmm. And Elizabeth, any projections for what we're going to see coming up?
I think we'll see a major attempt to convince the public. We will need a lot, or really the president will need lots of public pressure on members of Congress who might want to break with their party. And I think we'll see lots of negotiating. It will actually be forced. We haven't seen a lot of compromise so far, but if the Biden administration wants to get things through, there will be several votes that he will need to flip and people's minds that he will need to change. And so it'll be very, very interesting to see what actually happens and what gets passed versus what was announced in his speech to Congress.
Yeah, it seems like the follow-up is always what we've got to keep our eye on. You know, there's a lot of promises made, but do they actually make it through? Well, I want to thank you both for joining us this afternoon. It's been a pleasure. Ray Habersky, Professor of History and Director of American Studies at IUPUI, and Elizabeth Bennion, Professor of Political Science at IU South Bend. We'll be back after a quick break when we shift gears to the history of Sesame Street and the beloved children's show documentary Street Gang. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message without making a call by using our smartphone app. It's called All in Vox Pop, free and easy to use. Just look for it in your phone's app store. I'm Miriam Soeb. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. All right, and we are back with Michael Davis, Southern Region Manager for Solutions Journalism Network and author of the 2008 book Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street, which inspired a documentary of the same name. Michael, let's talk about the book before we delve into the documentary. What made you want to write about the history of Sesame Street?
Well, at the time, I was the senior editor at TV Guide, and children's television was part of my beat, my responsibilities. I did a story about the 35th anniversary of Sesame Street, put a lot of energy into the reporting of that story, and realized, my goodness, no one had ever taken on the complete story of the origin story of Sesame Street. And so I saw an opportunity and grabbed it.
And was there anything that really stood out to you as you were delving into the history of Sesame Street that you didn't know about before?
Yeah, no question did I realize that Sesame Street was born as a direct result of the civil rights movement. There's no question that the patriarchs and matriarchs of that show were driven by a response to Martin Luther King's assassination, and they all vowed to find a way to do something positive for Black children in the United States. Something that could make a difference. And what they decided was that they would tackle a gap that existed between kids from privileged homes and kids from non-privileged homes. One group of kids was, you know, being read to and had music and books in their homes, and the others did not. And therefore, when the underprivileged kids reached kindergarten, they were already behind the eight ball, behind their peers. And they wondered out loud if television could help make up that gap. Could there be a television show that presented basic concepts like your numbers, letters, shapes, concepts like under, around, and through? Could television help close that gap? What happened was, absolutely, it helped children in those neighborhoods they were shooting for, but it helped all children, as we all know. So many millions of kids from now many generations have gained from the show.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I remember watching it growing up. My children somewhat have watched it, but I feel like it's kind of changed over the years. And with so many different channels now, it's hard to focus on PBS. But
that's true. No question about that. This is the golden age of preschool children's television. There has never been a period like this where so much content is available, so much good content is available.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so when you were tackling this book, was there any sort of process that you went through? I mean, how did you structure it?
You know, right from the start, I saw a cinematic structure to the book. As a storyteller, I'm really into beginnings, middles, and endings. And I realized that I had a natural crisis that I could plant right before the third act, and that was Jim Henson's very untimely and in many ways unnecessary death. Jim Henson's death had reverberations not just for Sesame Street, but for our entire culture. Mm-hmm. So in sitting down to write it, I did have a structure in my mind, and it was very cinematic in nature.
Right. And well, Jim Henson, speaking of him, I mean, he had such an influential role. I just think of for my childhood, so many things that I watched, including Sesame Street. He had a hand in. What was his influence on Sesame Street?
Well, he was there from the very beginning when they were searching for the right combination of elements. And the founding executive producer, who is the key figure in my book, a guy named John Stone, had worked with Jim in previous projects. And he also had worked on Captain Kangaroo. And he realized that you could have interactions between, you know, real life people, actors and puppets to good effect. And so he said to Joan Ganz Cooney, the co-founder of Children's Television Workshop and Sesame Street, that if you're going to have a puppeteer, we have to have Jim Henson. And so he was there at the ground floor and helped to create the characters who are now so part of the culture. You can't imagine a world without them. Big Bird and Grover and Bert and Ernie and Cookie Monster. They were all, you know, the product of Jim Henson and his company's imagination.
And so your book now is a documentary. How did that happen? And what spurred that?
Can I say through the grace of God? Is that an acceptable answer?
Sure.
the book came out in 2008, and here we are in 2021, and it is now a full-length documentary. It took a lot of time and a lot of patience and a lot of hopefulness on my part that there might come a day when someone would adapt and faithfully adapt the book for the screen. I was very fortunate to have in my life a couple of producers based in Los Angeles who love the book and are Sesame Street nerds like myself. And they were just on fire to do this documentary. And so I was very fortunate to have met Ellen and Trevor Crafts, and also very fortunate to have gotten to know the director of the film, Marilyn Agrello, who is just brilliant. So, as someone who brought the content of Origin forward to this project, I couldn't be happier. It for me, when I watch the film, it's like all these people that I spent so long investigating and interviewing people about come to life on the screen, and it's a great feeling.
Yeah, to see your work sort of come to life in another form.
Yeah,
were there any stories or things that were in the book that didn't make it, or that didn't make it to the book that are now in the documentary?
Yeah, many actually, and that's why reading the book is a different experience from seeing the film. When you're making a documentary, you've got to really worry about the clock, and it had to come in at less than 2 hours. And many of the great stories from the book, and some of them are tragic, had to fall away so that Marilyn could concentrate on a smaller number of characters whose stories you learn about, and she takes you through this narrative arc that leads to a very satisfying, if a little teary, ending.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say there's so much material and stories, but there are also things that maybe people don't know about. There are some controversies that Sesame Street has gone through. Is there anything that you weren't able to include your book that came out later?
That came out later, no. But there are elements of the book that aren't going to be on the screen that I felt were really important. I'll give you one. There's an actor named Northern Calloway who played David on Sesame Street. And David on screen had a relationship with Maria, which was television's, if it wasn't the first interracial romance, it was among the first. And Northern was a very troubled guy who suffered from mental illness. And I take the reader through his decline and his eventual death at a mental hospital. And his was a very sad story, and one that, the workshop understandably didn't dwell on or really wanted to see made public. But I'm a journalist, and I give them a lot of credit for giving me full access to their archives and never getting in the way of my interviewing so that I could tell a story like that. Not everything was wonderful. And there were some very painful episodes through the years, including a brilliant puppeteer who died from AIDS. And that story is in the book as well.
Was it difficult to find these stories or to get access? I know you mentioned that they were helpful to you, but was there anything where it was just like, no, you can't?
Well, here's my advice to young writers. Try to write a book about people who are still alive. complicating my work is the fact that almost all of the central characters had gone to their reward. And so, you know, I had to bring these people, exhume them and bring them back to life through the words of others. So, you know, would I have loved to have interviewed Jim Henson? You bet I would have. Would I have loved to have interviewed Joe Raposo, the brilliant musician and composer who gave life to so many cool songs that we all know from Sesame Street? Yeah, of course. But the reality was that I had to talk to their peers. I had to talk to their husbands and wives, to their associates, to band members, to, you know, to really have a full understanding of what these people who worked at a genius level of accomplishment, who they really were. And, you know, to a man, they all, and a woman, they all had frailties, human frailties, mm-hmm. which was, you know, great, right? I mean, it makes the book authentic.
Right, right. Just to see the human side, because we see this sort of projection on our screens, but they're actors on those screens.
Yeah. And there are a lot of painful things that happened through the years. And, you know, just the struggle to keep the show on the air. You know, there were political push. There was political pushback. There was, you know, the fact that it was on a young network. PBS was in its infancy when Sesame Street came to America. And, you know, it was a struggle to keep it on the air. And here we are, you know, 52 years later, and the show still serves its audience well. It's different. Sesame Street 2021 is quite different from what it was in 1969 when it debuted. But I think what's so cool is the co-productions of Sesame Street dotted around the world. You can't name a hotspot, a global hotspot that Sesame Street hasn't landed in the culture, you know, whether it's Kosovo or Northern Ireland or, you know, South Africa during the era of HIV AIDS spread in that country. You can't name a hotspot that didn't have a version of Sesame Street doing good for people everywhere.
Right, right. I mean, I'm thinking there were so many, even, I don't know if it's fair to call them knockoff shows, but they were influenced by Sesame Street enough to create their own versions. I saw one in Arabic as a kid. I think it was out of Kuwait. And it was really interesting because it was like, I'm like, this is kind of like Sesame Street, but the characters aren't all the same. A little confused.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, so many of those co-productions were done, you know, with Sesame Workshop employees, and you know, the puppeteers would travel the world and train people in those countries and how to make these characters come to life. It's a great story to be told about the good that Sesame Street co-productions have done on every continent but Antarctica. And give them time, they'll be in Antarctica for sure.
Yeah, somehow. I mean, this is very, very fascinating. And so I'm curious about this documentary. It's coming out soon. What's the response been so far for the folks that have been able to see it?
Well, I'm pleased to say it's, first of all, it debuted at Sundance and it sort of became the darling of the festival. It was among the best reviewed movies to come out of that film festival. And since that time, it has been released in theaters. It was in 140 theaters across the nation last weekend. This weekend, in addition to being in theaters, it'll be available on streaming services and Amazon, iTunes, and, you know, major streaming media companies are releasing it for what's called premium on demand. So this weekend will result in a lot more eyeballs on the screen and a lot more reaction. But at the moment, RottenTomatoes.com, the movie has a 97 critical rating and a 92 rating from filmgoers, and that's crazy good. So we're really happy.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's especially considering it's a documentary, right? So what are maybe some highlights you can share with us, something that we can look forward to seeing in the documentary?
Well, I think what people are delighted with is the outtakes and the sort of comedic moments from real life that the are captured in archival film. It was a guy named Vincent DiNapoli, still alive, who was sort of as his hobby took like home movie kind of film of the studio, what was happening behind the scenes. So the filmmakers were able to acquire this wonderful behind the scenes stuff. And it's just great to see Jim Henson and Frank Oz kind of goofing off and what they did when the cameras weren't on. And, you know, these guys, they spent 13, 14, 15 hours in the studio every day, churning out 130 episodes of Sesame Street a year at the beginning. So, you know, you're able, as a result of this wonderful footage, to feel what it was really like on the set. And I think that's the real delight, the outtakes. And without giving anything away, you know, the credit roll in this documentary is like any other credit roll I've ever seen, in that it absolutely brings the audience back up in a big way. And you can't help but leave the theater with really smiling at what you've seen.
Well, it all sounds great. I'm smiling right now just thinking about checking it out. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Michael Davis, Southern Region Manager for Solutions Journalism Network and author of the book Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street, which inspired a documentary of the same name in theaters now. Our producers are Drew Dodlin, Micah Yasin, and Tim Brooks. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross, our engineer, and composed our theme song. Join us tomorrow when we talk about tax credits. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.